Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. This is episode 139, and like we do most years, we are doing a special episode because this will be released the week of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday for 2022. The seminal accomplishment legislatively of Martin Luther King's advocacy was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I mean, I guess you could put the 65 Voting Rights Act on that list. And the 64 Civil Rights Act came after very disappointing legislation in 1957, watered down legislation in 1957 to 1960 had passed and been signed by President Eisenhower. Now, President Eisenhower's administration had wanted, led by the Attorney General Herbert Brownell, had wanted a stronger bill in 1957. Ironically, that bill was watered down by the Senate, led by Lyndon Johnson of Texas, who was very close with the Southern senators. The leader of the Southern senators was Richard Russell of Georgia. So I want to talk a little bit about Florida in these legislative battles, 57 and 60 to a lesser extent, but really 64, and the role played by legislators from the state of Florida. So in 1957, the deal that was made by Lyndon Johnson with Richard Russell watered the bill down, weakened the bill down from what the Eisenhower administration, led by Attorney General Brownell and, quite frankly, Vice President Nixon. I mean, this is something I keep stressing in our conversations here on the Florida History Podcast, is that Richard Nixon was really a civil rights liberal in the 1950s, and he pivoted to being, quite frankly, a race baiter when he won in 68 the presidency and got reelected in 72. In 72, he won with huge majorities in the South among white voters and racial backlash, anti-busing. He had obviously also tried to nominate a number of segregationists to the Supreme Court. So Nixon completely flipped on this issue. Nixon remained, there were some strains of liberalism in Nixon's political philosophy even after 1968, but on the issue of race and civil rights, he was a conservative. And the Southern strategy put together by Kevin Phillips and Harry Dent and others for Nixon's 68 campaign was in fact effectively the harbinger of Reagan conservatism and onward to the election of Donald Trump as a Republican in 2016. But in the 1950s, Nixon was a liberal on civil rights, and he and other members of the Eisenhower administration were very concerned about the black vote and felt like that was a key. And when I talk about the African American, the black vote in that case, I think they were really looking at northern cities, right? Nixon was, knowing he was going to run in 1960, wanted African American votes out of Chicago, wanted African American votes out of New York and Detroit and Cleveland. These were all cities in swing states. In those days, New York and Illinois were the ultimate swing states, believe it or not. They're heavily Democratic now, but they were swing states in the 1940s and 1950s. And Ohio and Michigan remain swing states. I mean, Ohio now, I think, is pretty much moved into the Republican column. But those two states, those would be really kind of the cities with a major focus. Oh, and obviously Philadelphia. Pennsylvania remains a swing state to this day. But so that was the thinking. 1957, there was no support for civil rights at all in the state of Florida. Leroy Collins had tried to take our governor had tried to take a very moderate line on the civil rights issue, and had failed, quite frankly, to do convince the legislature, which tried to override his vetoes on some things, and then the political climate in the state kind of had a counter reaction to Collins. Right, Collins being this racial moderate led to an incredible amount of racial demagoguery in Democratic primaries. The Democratic primary to succeed Collins in 60, and the Democratic primary for other offices. So the entire congressional delegation in 57, or House delegation, voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1957. Now, interestingly enough, the Senate, there was the deal where Lyndon Johnson watered down the bill and didn't, and Richard Russell agreed not to filibuster the bill, even though Strom Thurmond embarrassed Russell and the deal that was made by going on and giving the record length filibuster on the Senate floor. Russell and some of the other Southerners thought Thurmond was a buffoon, right? They thought, you know, that Russell was a racist, but he tried to give these very intellectual arguments about constitutionalism and you're actually helping the African Americans. But Thurmond gave out and out racist rhetoric. So anyway, when we get to Florida, George Smathers was very ambiguous about this 57 Civil Rights Act. He ultimately votes no on final passage, but he was ambivalent about voting no, I would say. If you look at the historical record up to that point, if any Southerner outside of Texas is Ralph Yarborough. Actually, I don't know if Yarborough was in the Senate yet in 57. Yarborough was in the Senate in 57. Yeah, Yarborough was an out-and-out liberal, right? He would have been liberal even in Massachusetts. So Yarborough voted for every civil rights bill, every piece of legislation, only Southerners to do so. But outside of Yarborough and then the Tennessee duo of Al Gore Sr. and Estes Kefauver. Kefauver was another out-and-out liberal and a great man, in my opinion, who was taken from us too soon. Kefauver, Yarborough are out-and-out liberals. Gore is, by Southern standards, very liberal, like his son was. So they vote for the Civil Rights Act of 57. Smathers was close to voting for it, which is something I didn't realize until recently. We did this Smathers project here at the Florida History Podcast and the FloridaSqueeze.com, and I've discovered Smathers was very... He wouldn't have voted for a strong civil rights bill, and we learned that in future years, right? He did vote for the Voting Rights Act in 65, actually, one of the few Southern senators, again, to do so. But he was open to voting for the 57 civil rights bill, actually. Spessard Holland, the other Democratic senator from Florida, was very much opposed. Holland had also been involved in filibusters against anti-lynching legislation in the past. So can kind of tell you. And Florida had the most per capita lynchings in the U.S. between 1901 and 1950. So that can kind of tell you where Holland was. Old-time Southern conservative. 1960, Dante Fussell of Miami Congressional District, votes yes on the 1960 Civil Rights Act, which, again, didn't do very much. It codified some things. It was a bill very much Nixon wanted as he was running against Kennedy, and he was seeking African-American votes. And Nixon had some very prominent African-Americans behind him. In fact, I think had he made a phone call to Martin Luther King Jr., he would have gotten more support, including from Martin Luther King Sr., who was favorably disposed to Nixon over Kennedy prior to that phone call. And that phone call changed everything. That phone call, which Harris Wofford, future senator from Pennsylvania, had JFK place, really changed history. By the way, another great man, Harris Wofford, who passed away in the last decade or so. So then we get to 64, which is what we wanted to talk about. And in 64, Martin Luther King and Andrew Young and Ralph Abernathy and company set up shop in St. Augustine. St. Augustine, the oldest European settlement in the country, is going to be the focal point for their efforts to bring attention to their plight in advance of the vote for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We are going to replay shortly a piece we did in a previous year on the St. Augustine movement in 64. So I don't need to repeat that right now. That will be after this monologue. We'll be talking about the 64 St. Augustine movement and what happened down here in St. Augustine in 1964 with Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy, Andy Young, and the rest of the civil rights leadership descending on Florida. But in the Congress, which is what I wanted to focus on, in the House, Lyndon Johnson brilliantly pushed his allies to get the bill discharged from Howard Smith's judiciary, Howard Smith's Rules Committee, which was a committee, by the way, we talked about last week on this podcast, that was chaired by Claude Pepper many, many years later. So Claude Pepper has just been elected from a new Miami area district. And we know he was favorable towards African-American rights. Pepper votes yes after the bill was discharged from the committee with the help of Martin Luther King's movement. In fact, Martin Luther King was able to get that bill out of the House Rules Committee and discharge, and Smith to push it, to almost get it discharged via discharge petition. Smith scheduled a vote just to save face. Was able to network with priests and rabbis from all over the country. So it was pretty awe-inspiring, the campaign that religious leaders could put together because of their reverence for Martin Luther King. And so they get the bill out. They get the bill out of the House. As I said, only one Florida rep, which was Claude Pepper, voted for it. Everybody else voted against it. In the case of congressmen like Bob Sykes and Don Fuqua, Charlie Bennett, who we've done the previous podcast on, their districts would have been impossible to vote for it. You can look at some of the other members. Why did Sam Gibbons vote against it from Tampa? I think it was a tough vote for any Southerner, but that was an urban area. Although Hillsborough County had produced some real racists, and some of the most racist leaders or most demagogic racists in the state had come from Hillsborough County. So that might have been a consideration. Why did Dante Fussell, who had voted for the 60 Civil Rights Act, vote against it? I don't know. Why did Paul Rogers, who had a fairly moderate voting record, both Broward County, Broward Palm Beach County district, why did he vote against it? Again, Florida was a southern state, but it also wasn't necessarily like a southern state. And the Texas delegation was pretty split. If you want to, Florida and Texas are the most natural comparison. And Texas had a lot of people who voted, a lot of House members, Jack Brooks, who was the future chair of the Judiciary Committee, among others, who voted for civil rights. He was from Beaumont. There was no positive incentive for him sitting in Beaumont, Texas, to vote for it other than principle, and he voted for it. There were several other Texas reps that voted for the Civil Rights Act. So that was a very, very interesting thing that Florida didn't have anyone support it other than Pepper. Only a yes vote from the Deep South was Charles Weltner from Atlanta. From an Atlanta area district, ironically enough, Andrew Young would be representing like 8 years later, as African Americans were enfranchised, and Andy Young became the first congressman, really a worthy first congressman from the South that was African American post Reconstruction, having been one of Martin Luther King's chief lieutenants. And that district eventually was won by John Lewis, another great civil rights hero. And in that primary, he beat Julian Bond, another civil rights icon. So, and that's Atlanta, right? Atlanta has so many of the great civil rights leaders. So many of them either were from Atlanta or ended up in Atlanta. So the bill goes to the Senate, and that's where the fun begins. Richard Russell and his group filibuster the bill. And George Smathers, along with Spessard Holland, joined that filibuster. They take part in the filibuster. And this wasn't just, hey, we're voting against cloture. This was, hey, we're going to the floor, because you have to talk in those days, and we're going to talk, and we're going to talk and talk and talk, and we're going to wear down the Northern liberals. We're going to wear down Hubert Humphrey and Douglas from Illinois and all of the Northern liberals, Jacob Javits, Republican senator from New York, very, very liberal on civil rights and on issues of race. He was Jewish, by the way. So we're going to wear down Javits. We're going to wear down Humphrey. They're going to eventually have to make a deal with us because we're frustrating them. But in the case of guys like Javits and Humphrey, they had been waiting their entire careers for this legislation in that form, because it didn't get watered down coming out of the House, and Lyndon Johnson promised not to water it down. He had given Martin Luther King his word in a White House meeting. So the filibuster is incredibly effective, and Johnson does not have the 67 votes he needs. But he starts lobbying, and this is where, again, King, you'll hear more about it if you haven't listened to our previous podcast on St. Augustine, the St. Augustine movement, what he was doing in St. Augustine at the time. But at the same time, he was organizing, again, priests, rabbis, people from people of faith all over the country to pressure their senators to put an enormous amount of pressure, particularly on Democrats from Western states who had traditionally had an alliance with the Southern Democrats, and who were also not really, they didn't have many African Americans in their state, and they were committed to the idea of the filibuster and regional vetoes effectively on legislation, which is something the South had since the beginning of the Republic, right? The South had effectively a veto over the business of the United States Senate going back to the election of 1800. With the exception of the Reconstruction period, from 1800 to 1964, they effectively had a veto over federal legislation because they controlled the Senate one way or another. And even in 64, the committee chairs are largely, anytime the Democrats were in the majority, the committee chairs were Southerners. Anytime the Republicans were in the majority, they were more conservative, their leadership, so they deferred to the Southern Democrats on racial issues. So that was the problem, right? You know, you didn't have, I mean, I mentioned Javits was a Republican. You had others, Charles Mack Mathias from Maryland, was a great liberal Republican, Clifford Case. There were a lot of liberal Republicans from the Northeast in those days who were committed to civil rights, but they weren't running the Republican Party. They weren't running the Republican caucus in the Senate. So Everett Dirksen's the minority leader from Illinois, conservative Republican. He had beaten, he'd beaten the majority leader, Scott Lucas, in 1952 to win his seat, the Democratic majority leader, Scott Lucas, who was a fairly liberal Democrat, but pretty ineffective as a majority leader, quite frankly. So, because again, Lucas, you know, couldn't break the Southern bloc. There was especially in the 40s and 50s, there was this coalition that governed, that really ran the Senate, which was a combination of Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans, and they had 50 plus votes for anything to block anything. Oftentimes had 67 votes. So, Humphrey eventually becomes a go-between with the White House and makes a deal with Dirksen to get the bill through. But here in Florida, we had issues, as I said, with in the St. Augustine movement, which we're going to hear about again in a minute. And Holland and Smathers are part of the filibuster till the bitter end. And there are some ridiculous arguments. George Smathers goes on television and makes some absolutely inane arguments during that period. I mean, embarrassing arguments when you look at the context and intellect of the man, which we spent some time talking about, right, in this show, the last couple months. It's just, you know, stupid stuff. But then, you know, the other thing that was kind of interesting is that as the debate wore on, Smathers became more and more kind of reluctant to make the kind of arguments he had been making, and started softening his arguments and talking about the Constitution and all this stuff, and then public will in Florida. Holland never softened his arguments. He was very, very much a believer in separation of the races. So the filibuster breaks. Civil rights legislation of 1964, Civil Rights Act of 1964 passes. Lyndon Johnson signs it, hands a pen, first pen he signs with, to Martin Luther King. But both our senators in Florida voted no. They were both Democrats, Holland and Smathers. The little postscript on this is a year later, the Voting Rights Act comes up in front of the Senate after Selma. And we've talked a little bit in the past about Leroy Collins' role in Selma. And to the point where, look, Collins was known as an out-and-out liberal on race to the other Southern Democrats. So James Eastland, who was the viciously racist chairman of the Judiciary Committee, there's a, now the last 20, 25 years, the tapes of LBJ's, from LBJ's White House have been released, and we hear this tape of Eastland furiously calling Lyndon Johnson about, you know, appointing Collins. That's it to the community assistance program. That's as good as appointing the N-word, effectively, is what Eastland said. So Collins has a role in the administration, and he facilitates the kind of the peace that finally prevailed in Selma, unfortunately after some tragedy, but that peace that eventually prevailed. And Collins, I don't think gets enough credit in history. But interestingly enough, George Smathers votes for the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Holland, again, doesn't. Holland is part of a filibuster. I should say Smathers voted no on cloture. He stuck with the Southerners on that and then broke when the bill actually, once it was, the filibuster was broken on that, he voted yes, which you could say it was a strategic vote because that meant African Americans were going to vote. There weren't many yes votes in the South, obviously. I think Russell Long may have voted yes from Louisiana. Gore from Tennessee, and obviously Yarborough voted for every civil rights bill. Again, Yarborough from Texas was, he would have been a liberal even in New York or in California, right? He was a real liberal and the patron saint of liberalism in Texas, up to the point where, in fact, I was reading a letter from Ted Kennedy, written many, many years ago, where Ted Kennedy said, when I got elected to my brother's seat after he became president, I won a special election. I asked my brother, who was president, John F. Kennedy, who should I take after in the Senate? And you're expecting Kennedy to say, you know, I know, Abe Ribicoff from Connecticut, who's a great liberal also. Yeah, someone else from the Northeast. And he says, oh, you know, emulate Yarborough. He's the guy. And he's the real liberal. He's a genuine article. Which probably irritated LBJ, because we also know the Yarborough-Connolly dispute. Conservative faction John Connolly, liberal faction Ralph Yarborough was the reason why JFK had to go to Dallas anyway. And LBJ was effectively siding with Connolly at that time. Although, once LBJ became president, his agenda became very, very tied to Yarborough's agenda. So anyway, that's 64 Civil Rights Act and kind of Florida's role legislatively in it. Now we're going to play our piece from a previous Martin Luther King Day. I think it was 2020, actually, we recorded this, as I had actually been in St. Augustine on Martin Luther King's birthday in 2020, right before the coronavirus pandemic. I haven't done much traveling since that began, but on the St. Augustine movement. So enjoy, and thank you once again for listening to the Florida History Podcast. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about civil rights, and more specifically the St. Augustine movement and Martin Luther King's involvement here in the state of Florida, and the pivotal role that St. Augustine movement played, and Dr. King being here in the state of Florida with other civil rights leaders like Andrew Young and Ralph Abernathy in passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 through Congress, breaking the Senate filibuster, the Southern Senator filibuster, and passing civil rights laws. Actually, something that is not always talked about. You see lots of movies, documentaries about Lyndon Johnson, Martin Luther King, Civil Rights Act of 1964, the debate in Congress, etc. All the way comes to mind the recent HBO film, Bryan Cranston playing LBJ. You don't always get the context of what was going on at the time in the movement. So we're going to focus on that today as part of the celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Most of the discussion of the civil rights movement, and probably for good reason, is around states like Mississippi and Alabama, Georgia, the violence that was happening there, the movements that were happening there. But actually, at the time of the passage, the great debate and passage of the civil rights movement of 1964, the greatest activity in the civil rights movement was taking place here in Florida, in St. Augustine. The father of the St. Augustine movement was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Robert Hayling, who was from Tallahassee, was a graduate of Florida A&M University.
Yeah, actually, just passed away a few years ago in Fort Lauderdale. But he was he moved to St. Augustine in 1960. He was a dentist and was a academic as well. And he began a movement in St. Augustine. The idea Hayling had was to protest the St. Augustine is the oldest European settlement in the United States, or what is currently the United States. Hayling knew that the 400th anniversary of St. Augustine's founding was coming up in 1965. Pedro Menendez founded the city in 1565, as I think most of our listeners know. So the goal of the movement was to draw attention to St. Augustine and the segregation in the Deep South, in Florida, in St. Augustine, in time for that 400th anniversary, the beginning of the 400th anniversary. And in fact, had some success, had Lyndon Johnson come and speak and demand an integrated ballroom at a segregated hotel, the Ponce de Leon Hotel. But that speech by LBJ in 1963, when he was still vice president, had little impact. It's integrated the ballroom, integrated the event for a night, and St. Augustine returned to its ways and the ways of Florida at the time when the vice president left and went back to Washington. So enter Martin Luther King. Hayling met the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at a conference in Orlando, and he invited King to St. Augustine in the spring of 1964, and St. Augustine then became ground zero for the fight over the civil rights movement. As the battle was raging in the U.S. Senate, the filibuster of the Southern members of the U.S. Senate, which included Florida's two U.S. senators, Spessard Holland and George Smathers, as they were filibustering the civil rights law, ground zero for civil disobedience. And the Reverend Martin Luther King, who had given less than a year earlier that great I Have a Dream speech in the March on Washington, was here in the state of Florida in St. Augustine. In 1963, there had been a sit-in protest like there had been in so many other places, including Tallahassee, including famously Greensboro, North Carolina, a sit-in protest at a Woolworth's lunch counter. It ended in the arrest and imprisonment of 16 young black protesters and 7 juveniles. Four of the African-American children, 16-year-old girls, and 2 of them were sent to reform school. Unbelievable. Even Jackie Robinson spoke out, and the NAACP spoke out, and Northern newspapers spoke out. So St. Augustine was already establishing itself as a center, an epicenter of white racism and of white resistance to the civil rights movement, maybe not quite as colorfully as Selma, Alabama, and Birmingham, and Montgomery, and some of the places, Philadelphia, Mississippi, would in the future, but certainly on the front lines, and certainly in terms of Florida, giving the state a black eye, a state that depended heavily on tourism, a lot more than Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina did, on tourism of people from the north, and for foreign visitors to the state, really giving the state an awful reputation. So St. Augustine, ground zero. We're in the spring of 1964. Let's talk a little bit about Martin Luther King's road forward in the St. Augustine movement. Local activists led by Hayling decided to contact Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for help. St. Augustine was being overrun by Klansmen in late 1963 and early 1964. In the spring of 64, Hayling put out a call to Northern college students to come to St. Augustine for spring break, but to not to go to the beach like they would in Daytona or Fort Lauderdale, really was a big spring break destination in the 1960s, immortalized in the movie Where the Boys Are. But to come to work, to be activists in the civil rights movement, to take part in civil rights activities. And this included several people who were connected to prominent businessmen in the North, prominent politically connected families. So this brought international attention to St. Augustine, or more international attention to St. Augustine, another black eye for the state of Florida, who under the governorship of Ferris Bryant were fighting the Civil Rights Act. the implementation. Ferris Bryant had spoken in front of the Senate Commerce Committee in hearings about the bill, and as I mentioned earlier, Florida's two U.S. senators had joined in the filibuster against the bill. And in the U.S. House, I should mention, Florida at the time had 12 members of that U.S. House. 11 of them had voted against the Civil Rights Act. The lone yes vote was, unsurprisingly, from Claude Pepper, who we've talked about on a previous episode of the show, great champion of liberalism, New Deal liberalism. And he was representing Miami, which was like a northern city at that point. And you even see throughout the 60s, Miami's voting patterns were more like that of New York City or Boston or Philadelphia than like other southern cities, even unlike southern cities like Atlanta and Nashville that were tended to be ahead of more urban and more cosmopolitan than the rest of the South. So during these protests in St. Augustine, attempts were made to integrate the beaches on Anastasia Island, St. Augustine Beach. Demonstrators were beaten and driven into the water by segregationists. Some of the protesters couldn't actually swim and were almost drowned, and they were saved by other demonstrators. But there was no effort by law enforcement or by the local community to rescue them. So Dr. King, by this point, is in St. Augustine. In addition to Abernathy and Andrew Young and some of the others, Fred Shuttlesworth, some of the other great SCLC leaders are in St. Augustine at this point. So while there is a drama going on in the Capitol over Lyndon Johnson's civil rights bill, which is being filibustered, and Johnson is feverishly, and again, if you've watched some of these programs like All the Way and other documentaries or movies, documentaries about Lyndon Johnson, about Martin Luther King, you know how feverishly he was twisting arms to get that filibuster broken, but it took 2 months, and how hard Hubert Humphrey was working, the senator from Minnesota, the great senator from Minnesota, who would be the vice president to Lyndon Johnson, and who would run as be his running mate in the 64 election, how hard they were working to break the deadlock. Meanwhile, you have this situation in St. Augustine. There can be no doubt that what viewers saw in St. Augustine on their televisions, on the nightly news. And remember, in those days, you didn't have CNN and Fox News and MSNBC. You had the nightly news broadcasts on ABC, NBC, and CBS. You had Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley or Chet Huntley coming into your home every night. What happened during that period is people from around the country saw what was going on in St. Augustine, and they called their senators, and they flooded their senators with mail, to the point where finally, on June 10th, the filibuster was finally broken in the U.S. Senate. Finally. And 71 votes for cloture, they go on to pass the Civil Rights Act through the Senate. Dr. King is still in St. Augustine at this point. I think it's very important for us who studied Florida history to understand that Dr. Martin Luther King was actually in the state of Florida when the filibuster was broken. Cloture was achieved on the 1964 Civil Rights Act. He gets arrested the next day, June 11th, on the steps of the Monsoon Martyr Lodge restaurant. That is when he famously wrote his letter from St. Augustine jail to a friend of his, Rabbi Israel Dresner from New Jersey. He urged Rabbi Dresner to recruit rabbis to come to St. Augustine and take part in the movement. The result of that was the arrest of 18 rabbis who heard the call from Dr. King and Rabbi Dresner and came to St. Augustine to try and integrate the motel, integrate the swimming pool in the motel. It was the largest, and it still is the largest, mass arrest of rabbis in American history. The rabbis, after they were thrown in jail in St. Augustine, also published an open letter, a manifesto titled Why We Came, or Why We Went, and that moved lots of people around the country. Things came to a head when a group of black and white protesters jumped into a swimming pool at the Motor Lodge, at the Monsoon Motor Lodge. In response to the protest, the manager of the hotel, who was actually the president of the Florida Hotel and Motel Association, poured some sort of chemical substance, some sort of acid into the pool to try and injure, you know, physically injure or burn the protesters. photographs of this went around the world, again, on those nightly news broadcasts, international news, causing great embarrassment to the United States. Again, this is the middle of the Cold War. Castro has just come to power in Cuba a few years earlier. Very, very embarrassing. We're about to deepen our commitment in Vietnam. This is about a month and a half before the Gulf of Tonkin resolution passed. So just think about the world as it is and how embarrassing this was to the U.S.'s moral authority and moral credibility. So at that point, Ferris Bryant, the governor, anti-civil rights, he finally realizes this is just impacting the reputation and image of Florida beyond repair, forms a committee, which was biracial, to try and resolve the dispute. Dr. King, Abernathy, Andrew Young, Williams, Shuttlesworth, the rest of them all leave St. Augustine the next few days. St. Augustine made a big difference in the civil rights movement, in pushing what was an important change here in the state of Florida and bringing light to the darkness of Florida's racial practices at the time, and had a huge impact on national legislation and the civil rights law. So thanks once again for listening to the Florida History Podcast. We will be back with another new episode next week. Robert will be back, and we'll be talking about a golden age in Florida history, just a few years after this very lamentable period when Florida was rightly embarrassed for its racial practices when one Reuben Askew became the governor of the state in the 1970s.